First, I would like to say up front that I am not an authority on economics, nor am I an authority on the stock market, nor am I an authority on why the banks closed. But I would like to tell you on this day about my experiences, my relationship, my involvement with the 30s and possibly on into the 40s. There were no agencies in those days, no federal, no state agencies, no county agencies, but we the people were caught up in this economical disaster, which overnight placed people without money. They lost it in their banks. They lost their stock. A lot of them were unemployed. But we did not have any agencies to bring you a paper or a script and say, this is the way we should do it. You do it like this, and you do it like this, and you do it like this, and sign it and mail this form in, and everything I think will work out. But it did not. We did not have those. It was the people, the populace, with pride, ingenuity, hard work, sacrifice, anything that it took to work ourselves out of this involvement, which would take 10 or 12 years to come out of this disaster, and which was a disaster. But at that time, or this time, the people accepted that. Everyone was happy. I was happy. My parents were happy. My neighbors were happy. Everyone seemed to be on the upbeat because they accepted this challenge. In the early 30s, the banks had closed. If you had $300, which my father had in the bank in his checking account, which was a lot of money then, but he lost that. He had $5 to his name. He had a job. And as time went on, people became more and more unemployed because there was no construction going on, no building, practically nothing. So people were out of work. At the time of my early youth, my early adolescence, I was living in Hayhira, Georgia, living on the main thoroughfare from Maine to Florida, which is US 41 Highway. And I lived there. And as we began to notice more and more transits, we call them hitchhikers, were coming down the highway. And they were usually coming from north to south. And I think the reason they were coming from north to south, they were hoping that life would be better in the Sunshine State in Florida, maybe employment. The railroads, a lot of freight trains, maybe two or three, they would come through Hayhira. And we call those hobos. And they would be riding, just riding, hoping that there would be something better down the track. My mother was one of the ingenuous ladies back in those days. We did not have freezer lockers. We did not even have ice boxes. We had ice that we kept, some kind of container. But these ingenuous ladies, there was no canning, metal canning done in those days, but they would preserve, and they would take their fruits, their peaches, or watermelon rind preserves, which I've never heard of since then, which was a delicacy, they made those, and different things. And we had a cow that gave 2.5 gallons of milk a day, so we always had plenty of dairy products. And Mother was a good biscuit maker, so we had plenty of ingredients to make the biscuits. And these hitchhikers invariably would come to thy door and knock and say, may I have something to eat? And she never turned one away. She would take one of her biscuits, which was good size, open it up, put a thick layer of preserves or whatever in there, and give them a glass of milk, and they would be on their way. We were fortunate. We had a garden, and we had a cow. And in this garden, actually, we planted all kinds of vegetables. And our neighbors usually had small gardens. So we were fortunate in having a place to grow our own food. My father had another little plot of land across town, and he planted that one spring in peanuts. Nothing but peanuts. I was 9 years of age. And all the peanuts that we gathered, we would bring them to our house in the summer, and my mother would boil them in a big iron wash pot. And then I would take them and take a tea glass about this high and about that big around and put them in a paper sack and take them down to our little town, Hayhara, and to the tobacco market warehouse. And I would sell these peanuts for 5 cents a pack, a package. One day I sold 104 packages, $5.20. I will never forget that. That was all the money in the world. One year off that one summer off that one plot of ground, I sold $40 worth of peanuts. In turn, my mother took the $40 and purchased my clothing, school clothing, even though she was a good seamstress, and prior to that made a lot of our clothing, but she bought me school clothing. I was perfectly happy with that achievement. The next year, my uncle had a grocery store. The next summer I worked, my uncle had a grocery store in Hayhara. And he hired me for the summer to deliver groceries, not by bicycle, but by walking. And my earnings for a week's pay, 6 days a week, was $1.50. A lot of money to a 10-year-old boy. Life was gleeful and a lot of fun to we younger people. We did not realize at that time the situation. Referring to my uncle's grocery store, he tried to operate it for 2 other years, and most of his grocery sales was charged. He put it on a big ledger book. And after about 2 years, his operating capital ran out, and not enough money was coming in to operate the business. So he closed his business. And the story was told later that he took the books and soaked them in kerosene and burned them because he knew that he would never recover the money that he had left for the groceries. My father was an automobile man, and I've always been an automobile man. And he was an automobile man when I was born. And he was a good automobile man. So in Valdosta, Georgia, there was a Chevrolet dealership here, Glisson Motor Company. And they knew about my father's, you know, workmanship and his attitude and professionalship in the automobile business. So they hired him, called him to Valdosta and interviewed him and hired him. And he drove back and forth for about a year and a half. They furnished the car and he paid the gasoline, bought his own gasoline. His pay as a sales manager was $20 per week. So you say, well, how do people make it? Well, back in those days, you could take $5 or less and buy groceries for a family for a week. And we always had plenty to eat. My mother always told me and tells me today, she's 94, still living. I was speaking with her just this morning. But she said to me, and it was truthful, it says, we always had clothes to wear, plenty to eat, but usually no money. She said there were times there would not be 1 cent in the house. Now, there's no cliche that I possibly could say this, that everyone was in the same boat. But anyway, my father drove back and forth to Hay Howard about us for approximately 2 years. And in 1933, we moved to Valdosta. And at that time, the First National Bank evidently had some repossessed homes or mortgaged homes that could not be paid for that they had taken back in. And my father rented a lovely big old home next door to the Carnegie Library, which the house does not exist anymore. But they wanted to sell it to my father, and he did not want to buy it. But he rented the house from these people from the bank approximately 2 years. And finally they kept insisting, let us sell you the house. Buy it on your terms, pay it like you want. So he bought this lovely old home in 35. He bought this lovely old home for $1,750. $1,750. I remained in the home until I left. In other words, I was there for many years. My family was there for many years before they moved to LA. So things were not good and things were not bad.
What about your high school days?
Before I get to that, yeah. I was spent some time. I went to high school. I went to junior high school, which was just across the street from where I lived. And I went to high school. And I would like to take this opportunity to tell you about our schools. Our schools were very disciplined. The teachers, the principal, the superintendent had complete control. There was no out of line. If you were out of line a little bit, you remained 1 hour after school. If you got out of line too much, you came back to school on Saturdays. You spent almost a full day in school on Saturday. The teachers were paid approximately $90 per month. The teachers were committed, not saying they're not committed today. They were committed to teach, and they taught. They were wonderful people, and they did the best they could to teach us. And the subjects, I think, were more difficult then than they are now. It was quite an experience. While I was in school, I was always a person that wanted to work. I've always enjoyed working. In fact, I'm 73 years old, soon be 74, and I continue to work some today because I still enjoy it. But I enjoyed working. And so I went to work at the theater. Now, in those days, there was two forms of entertainment. There was no television. There was the radio, and there was the theater. And we had this majestic old theater in our city in Valdosta called the Ritz. And it seated about 1,000 people, including the balconies. And they changed the program 3 times a week. I was most fortunate as a young man to be able to work in the theater. I never tired. My beginning pay was, I worked on Saturday only to begin with, as an usher. And I went to work at 10 o'clock in the morning. And I worked until about 9 o'clock Saturday night for $1.50 per day for that one day. And then I graduated up that I was ushering after school from 2 to 9 for $5 a week. That was 5 days a week and then Saturday. And would you believe that when I was 18 that I was appointed assistant manager of the Ritz Theater? And I was probably the envy of every young man in Valdosta. And my pay was $15 a week, and I could not spend all that money. You would not believe, because a dollar went a long ways in those days. You know, at this point, I'm speaking of the theater, at this point, for the last few years, I've been kind of down on Hollywood. And my reason is that I don't feel like I have to pay $4 or $5 to go see violence as much as they do, swearing, cursing, nudity, all the things that go with Hollywood at the same time. But let me tell you that Hollywood was probably the biggest morale builder during the 30s that could ever come along. Going to the theater was inexpensive if you had the money. You could go for a quarter, dime for children, 25 cents for adults. Popcorn was a nickel. Coca-Cola was a nickel. The point I'm making about the morale builder about the theater was the fact that they either came out of the theater either laughing or you came out crying. There was always a beautiful story or an upbeat musical, and they did put out some, oh, just wonderful musicals. Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers, that type of thing, which took your morale and brought you up. You came out feeling wonderful, even though we were living in painful times, economical strait. My mother, I'm going back a little bit, my mother would some days call me out playing, and she would say, take this 35 cent, a quarter and a dime, and go downtown on Patterson Street and get 35 cents worth of steak. And back in those days, they did not pre-cut your meat. They usually cut it as you ordered. And the steak would be wonderful meat. And we would bring that meat home and she would prepare it and serve my mother, she and my father and my two other brothers, and we would have meat remaining on the plate, 35 cents. I'm going, reverting back now a little bit up before my theater days, working. So I was a little entrepreneur, a little ingenious little boy, and I went to a candy store here in town. And back in those days, you could sell fireworks. Roman candles, skyrockets, boom, boom, firecrackers. And I walked in and asked these Stewart sisters who owned the company, I said, would you do me a favor? Would you let me have some firecrackers on consignment? And they agreed to do that. I didn't have any money to buy them, but they wouldn't let me on consignment. And the manager of the Piggly Wiggly store agreed to let me sell in front of the store. So I set me up a little display up there. And I sold firecrackers for about 2 weeks and made myself some money. Quite a bit of little money for youngsters back those days. The conditions in our city or in our area at that time was a situation that teenage pregnancy was practically unknown. Divorce was practically unknown. Crime was practically unknown. We had a very small city jail. We had a very small county jail. And there were very few prisoners in the jail. If you elected to go to bed at night, chances are you'd leave your windows up. You would leave your doors unlocked. And chances are the keys in your car. And you did not have to worry about anyone taking anything from you. Prices, even though income was low, very low, commodities, therefore, were low also. And you could buy the best Chevrolet automobile, let's say in 1940 or 41, for less than $700. If you had the money to buy it. So commodities were low. You want it?
Just continue on. Okay, you want to tell us about your education?
Yeah, let me tell you about that.
Entering the service?
Yeah, let's do that. That's a good situation there. I went to Valdosta High School, and it was enjoyable. Played in the band, drumming bugle corps, played in the band, lots of fun. The people, the faculty, saw fit to try to keep we teenagers involved and entertained. And the young ladies were responsible for this. They called them tea dances. And to begin with, they had tea dance would be in the afternoon over at the American Legion Club, and it would be held at like 4 to 6 at the jukebox. And we would go there and enjoy ourselves. The young ladies would invite the young man to go with them, and she would pay the little interest fee, like a quarter or less. This went on for a couple of years, and then they moved the dances over to the high school, and we would have those at night, and they would be chaperoned. And there was not anything ever out of order. And everyone enjoyed themselves, and it was most entertaining to go to those, and we looked forward to those dances. On front of that. I would like to almost dedicate this tape to all people, whether they were adolescents, teenagers or what, older people, who went to the 30s, They were prideful, hardworking people, ingenuous people, patient people, and happy people. We were all in the same boat, as I said before. There was no one to help us. There was no food stamps or welfare, not anything like that. And grown men, if they could get a job in the earlier part of the 30s and on up into the middle 30s, if they could find a job such as construction or any type of labor, these men would work long hours for 50 cents on a dollar a day. And it was only with their hard work and their patience that they were happy, that they were able to do this. Now, groceries, as I'd mentioned before, were cheap, so was income low. And you could buy a sack, a 24-pound sack of flour for 98 cents. Buying bread and the loaf was almost unknown of. All the ladies made homemade bread. And this happened to a lot of the rural ladies. The flour companies designed a print, a cotton print sack, which was colorful. And these ladies would take these prints and make themselves dresses from this flower print. And they were not too proud to do that, because possibly they did not have 10 cents a yard for the money to buy the clothes. That would give you an example of people enduring. Just less than a half a mile from where I'm taping, where we're taping this today, was a house, a big old house over in the woods. Someone, I don't know if it lived there or not, that's been a long time ago. It was called, we called it the Poor House. And it was a place for people to go and stay if they did not have a place to stay. And I never went there, and it was always pointed out to me because you could see it from the road. But I think they had a hard time filling the five or six rooms in the old house, because people were too proud and too endurable to accept it. As I got out of high school, I went out to Moody Field, Georgia, which was a new base that had just opened after the World War, after Pearl Harbor. And I applied for a job, civil service job, with the federal government. And I went out there one day and I was interviewed and I was asked if I could type. And I said, yes, I'm a touch typist. And so they talked with me a little further and they hired me. And I was happy to have had the job and was not too anxious to find out what the pay would be, but anyway, I was hired. And the starting salary for the civil service for the federal government was $1,260 per year, which was $105 per month. And I served that job until I went into the U.S. Army Air Corps in 1942. Served there for 3 years and 4 months. After I came back from the service, I went to college for 2 years.
Where at?
South Georgia College at Douglas. I finally got 3 years of college yet another to get a degree. But anyway, what was we? I was
when you were going to college.
College, yeah. I went to college 2 years. By that time, I figured, hey, you're getting a little age on you, that's about the time maybe you should maybe go to work, although I want to go to college, brother. So this was in 48. So I went to Albany, Georgia for an interview with one of the larger corporations in the United States at that time, and probably today R.G. Reynolds Tobacco Company. It's R.G. R. Besco today. And I went for an interview in Albany, Georgia by one of the district managers and was hired on the spot to go to Montgomery, Alabama to be a public relations man and sales representative. Accepted the job. Was happy to have gotten the job. But the job paid $180, not per week, but $180 per month. So you see the involvement from the early 30s, even on up to 48, was still salaried, was still low. Although commodities were still proportionally low. I ran into a friend of mine, going back a little bit.
That's fine.
I ran into a friend of mine about my age, about a year ago, and she and I were chatting. And she and her husband made it well in life. They did right well. He's deceased now, she's still living. But she reminded me, we were talking about things back in the 30s. She reminded me that you had to be 15 to get employment at this particular place I'm gonna meet you. And she was only 14, so she storied a little bit about her age so she could get a job. And the job, the store, was back then was a big thing in our town, and probably other cities too in towns, was called the S.H. Cresson Company. We call it the Cresses. It's really called the dime store because practically every item that you bought in the store was not more than a dime, practically everything. So she was hired. She worked on Saturdays. And she went to work at 8:30 on Saturday morning and worked. The store stayed open late back those days till 11 o'clock at night. And she got paid on Tuesday. So when she'd go down on Tuesday to get her pay for that Saturday's work, the pay was 99 cents. She really earned a dollar, but they took out 1% Social Security. So that gave her a net earning 99 cents per day's work. Valdosta in the 30s, down on town on Saturday night was a lively place, real lively. You, instead of parallel parking, you parked your car at an angle. And every slot on Patterson Street and every slot on Ashland Street and any of the side streets was taken by automobiles. Some of them were old, very few of them brand new, but they were cars. And the point of this, it was almost a social gathering. People would park, sometimes hours. Stores stayed open late. The children would not be in any problem up and down the streets. People would drift in cars visited. And it was just a treatful place, and probably a morale builder just to get out. Of course, as I said before, you did not have television in those days, so you didn't stay home watching the Blue TV. But it was a fun time, and I was usually working, always had no job doing something, but I recall it very much.
I know before, when we talked, you mentioned the banks closing, yes, and the chaos. Will you tell us a little bit about that?
I will try. As I said before, I'm not an economic major. Mm-hmm. I'm not an authority.
In total panic?
But this is what happened in our area, and it happened around the nation. The stock market had crashed. Prior to this, they call it the boom area. Everything was booming. See, I'm young, but I heard the stories and recall a lot of skyscrapers were going up, booming. Everything was booming, booming. Stock market was flourishing. Everything was going up, almost like today. The stock market crashed before the banks closed. So when the stock market crashed, all the entrepreneurs, whether they were large or small or just investors, lost everything they had, because when it crashed overnight, that was it. No recovery. The banks were caught up in this area of boom, and they were lending money, maybe for business or homes or whatever. And people, you know, but when the banks' operating capital themselves ran out, then they didn't have any operating capital. They had spent the investors' money, in other words. And when they pulled a little curtain down on the door, and people went down and the bank didn't open that day, there was no money. In those days, you did not have federal guaranteed insurance on the deposit, as we have today. So they lost everything that they had, whether it was $300, $1,000, $2,000, $5,000, they lost every bit, no recovery, which at that time was possibly a lot of money. As we know today, we have the federal auditors that go around and check the banks, and the banks have to take out insurance to guarantee the depositor on his money up to $100,000. So I was told back when the banks closed, it took many years and people finally recovered about 11% of their loss, which, you know, was nothing.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any siblings, and did they work?
Yes, I have. My mother had four sons. Unfortunately, one of the boys, brothers next to me, died at the age of 18 months. That's when I was in Hay Howard, Georgia. And I have two. I have two other brothers who have lived their lives in Valdosta. And one is with the has been with the paper mill 40 some odd years, and the other one is about to retire from the city school system. And they were always fine friends, fine pals, and good brothers. And I tell you, I went to Alabama with R.J. Rose Tobacco Company. I don't know whether I told you where I was stationed, but I was in Montgomery, Alabama. Wonderful experience. I was with the R.J. Rose Tobacco Company. But I always had a spot in my heart for Valdosta, which is my home. And this is it. I would not want to live anywhere else other than this place. And I was in Alabama, and I decided one day that I would like to, after about 2.5 years, come back home. So I came back home and stayed a while, and then was hired by another corporation, which I thought would keep me in Valdosta. And it didn't work out that way. I moved about 4 times in less than 4 years, each time a little promotion. But so after about almost 4 years there, one day I said, this is it. I think I'll go back to Valdosta for good. So I came back here in 1953, thereabouts. And as I might have said before, I have spent my lifetime, all my working time in Valdosta in automobile business as a salesman, and have enjoyed it, and I've always enjoyed living here. This is home.
Well, can you tell us, how long do you think it was before it picked back up, the banks opened back up? Was this a 6-month thing, or
no,
two
the
or
banks,
three?
The banks, they didn't keep their doors closed too long. They reopened, but they just did not have, have the operating capital, which, you know, they just lost everything, like a bankruptcy, in essence. And the people saw that the banks were open again, and they began to come back to their banks. The fact that two banks, I believe I'm right in saying this, with it, Hay Harwin, they closed in 32, reopened and still in existence. So people began to come back and to, you know, do mm-hmm. business with them, and it gradually got itself back on its feet. But if you lost your money, you lost. I mean, there was no recovery, except I mentioned eventually you might have recovered about 11% of your loss. You know, but the banks have gradually evolved and got going again.
I know you mentioned you were fortunate enough to go to college.
Yeah.
Was this common? Were a lot of your peers you went to school
with? I'll honestly admit this, that when we came out of service, see, there were 16 million men and a few women in the service in World War II. You could not go anywhere in the nation and not see a uniform, believe me. You could go to the smallest town in Iowa, Kansas at midnight, and you'd see a uniform. And there were 16 million men and a few women all of a sudden dumped back into the society and the economy of this country. Mm-hmm. What were they going to do with them? What were you going to do for jobs for that many people?
I have
so
no idea.
So the government says, all right, they'd already planned this. Let's have the GI, government issue, I mean, GI Bill.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to go to college, we will pay your tuition, we will buy your books, and we will give you $65 a month, which was a little money in '46, if you go to college. A lot of we people elected to go to college. I don't think it's because, I don't think we were aspired after being in the service to become college students. But it was a matter of survival,
right,
or temporary survival till you could get your feet on the mm-hmm. floor, you know what I'm trying to say?
Exactly.
So that's what happened there. And there were like 50 or 55 boys from Valdosta going to South Georgia College themselves, and it was not a large college, probably had 400 or 500 students in those days. I wanted to say this. Do we still have some time?
Yeah, we have.
I want to say this, that some of my more enjoyable late teenage and young and a young man's life, and I want to say this in sincerity, one of the most exciting evolvements and things that I have known in my life is Ballard State University. I knew the college when there was 200 girls, small. And every Saturday night, the college had a dance. And we fellows would go to the dance, jukebox dance.
Right.
And it was fun. Now, I don't have a thing in the world against blue jeans today, my t-shirts, or whatever. But we young men in those days, when we went to date, I went to that dance. We had on our sport jacket, we had on our tie, and that was just the way it was.
Proper attire for
proper
the time.
Proper attire. And those young ladies, they call it, we call it senior hall, down, it was old dormitory, it was one down just close to George Avenue in the Sin.
Mm-hmm.
There was a little rec hall in there, and that's the way they would have their dances. And we would go down there. In fact, I went on up until I was in the service at Moody. Would go over Saturday night. I knew Miss Hopper. One of the halls is named after her.
Mm-hmm.
One of the sweetest old ladies that I've ever known. She was strict. She didn't put up with anything. She had fine girls out there. And yet girls' school of 200 girls to what, close to 10,000 students a day.
So you have seen a lot in your
most
lifetime.
Most exciting. And we try to support, we go to their, as much as we can over there. I go to their music, we go to the basketball games, and some football, some baseball, but it's been really exciting to see that.
Did you meet your wife?
I have a second marriage.
Okay.
Yeah, this is my second. No, I didn't. I met both the ladies I've been married to were local.
Okay.
Local ladies. Yeah. You know, just mm-hmm. right in this area. Yeah. My son, one of my sons was a manager of the Ballaster Wildcats, and one of my sons played football back in the 60s for the Ballaster Wildcats, and he played under Wright Bazemore, and he was the one I mentioned that played football was on two state championship teams and one national, so he still remembers that, and we talked about that occasion. Do you have anything else to ask me back about the 30s?
I think we'll conclude here, but I would like to ask you if
yeah.
you had one thing and only one thing that you could tell future generations about the Great Depression or what you learned from it.
What I sure.
Would you go over this with us before we conclude?
You know, when a catastrophe like that happens, I don't think you dwell on it. You make the best of it. And that's what the people did. They knew they had a thing that no one else could handle for them. I mentioned the government, see?
Right.
But they had to do it, and they did it. And the no one complained. And so if I had a thing to say, I just feel like that any situation can be handled if you make up your mind, just go do it. And that's exactly what people did. They just accepted it and said, this won't go on forever, but it won't go for a long time. Let's go make the best of it and let's just do what we can. And life did not stop, believe me, because from my experiences in life, probably more experiences that I gained and so what people could do was the 30s. I work for a man now, and he'll tell you, his name is Hall Parrish. He says he would give anything in the world, and he's much younger than I am, to have lived
during the Depression.
Depression, and you know, and up into the 40s and so forth. And there's another thing that I'm a music lover, and he likes music too, but anyway, was the big band. Now, we still have a little time?
Yeah.
I'd like to mention a little bit about that.
Go ahead.
That a lot of, I feel like personally, and you won't accept it, but the young people today have missed something if they could not experience the big band area. You've heard of that.
Yes, I have.
And I'm serious, because the big band area, the music that they were playing then, and that's been 50 and 55 years ago, they're still playing that music today on a lot of stations. Right? You can go on that one out of Albany, that's all you hear. The music will never die, because, well, I'm not saying each lyric of music today doesn't tell a story, but it was just something about it. And when I say the big band, I lost the Georgia small town, I was fortunate enough to see three or four of the big bands come through here. Mm-hmm. When I was in the service, I got to see two or three more. But people were, well, you take Sinatra, still living today, in his early 80s, late 70s. Well, when this area came along, he was about a 19-year-old singer with the Tommy Dorsey band. Well, he finally evolved into being one of the greater pop singers, but we had about 10 or 12 of the big bands, or more, probably 15, and they were all well known. And we didn't have television, as I was related earlier, but we had radio. And a lot of them were sponsored by big companies, and they'd have an hour program, maybe certain nights a week, that they'd do nothing but, you know, play on the over the radio. People would, speaking of radio in the 30s, you had a lot of serials, you know, like Continued Stories. You had Benny Goodman, you had people like that. The old gentleman just died recently. Anyway, you had these people that come on, and they would have their hour programs on radio, and people would be right there, because you see Cincinnati, Nashville, Tennessee, one or two other big cities had radio stations that would reach out. I mean, you could pick up Grand Ole Opry. Hey. In Valdosta, Georgia, from Nashville, Tennessee, like he was next door. But the radio was the big thing for entertainment. Sports. They just built a new parking lot back at the college. And that was a baseball field. Valdosta was a member of the Georgia-Florida Baseball League. And we had a farm team from the Brooklyn Dodgers at one time and the Detroit Tigers. And they had a league made up of several cities around here. And on any given night, there was standing room only. People went to the baseball, and it was good baseball. I mean, it was minor league, but it's still associated with, you know, professional teams, and they furnished the players. But that was always a high spot to see two or three baseball games, you know, a week, you know, when they were in town playing.
Well, we're going to conclude here. All right. Thank you so much for your time.
I've enjoyed it. I hope I haven't rambled too much.
Not at all.
I hope I've been informative.
You have been very informative,
and
we're going to conclude at this point.
All right.